welcome. You're listening to Nourish with Intention by Kosha Space, and I'm your host, Nikita Mehta. In each episode, we explore inspiring conversations with wellness experts, innovators, and souls driven by a deep sense of purpose. I am so excited for you to tune into these conversations and find the tools to nourish both on and off your plates. I am thrilled to introduce our guest today, Chef Samantha Gawing. Chef Sam is such an inspiring force. She started talking about food as medicine back in the late 1990s when no one was really talking about it. She's been pioneering the concept and is a celebrity chef, a clinical nutritionist, a spa cuisine guru, and has her own school. She's also a mentor for wellness entrepreneurs and is imparting her wealth of knowledge and experience. I have had the pleasure of personally knowing Chef Sam and having been mentored by her. I am beyond excited, that's why, to share her insights, her wisdom, and her passion for nourishing both body and soul with all of you today. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I enjoyed talking to Chef Sam. Sam, I am so happy to have you on my podcast. You were talking about food as medicine more than 20 years ago, I think, when no one really cared about it as much. And as someone who's recently discovered the power of food, and I'd say I'm still on that journey, it's honestly so inspiring to be talking to you. So welcome.
That's lovely to see you. Thank you for having me.
Since this podcast is called Nourish with Intention, I start with asking, what does nourish with intention mean for you?
Well, nourishing really refers to that the act of providing the body with the nutrients for optimal well-being. But for me, I go a little bit deeper. It's not just about that well-being. It's really about being helping you to be really clear about your intention. And as a yogi that I've started practicing in the 1990s, I began my yogic journey, and my teacher would always say, you know, be really clear about your intention. Every morning I would practice really early, and it wasn't always asana. It wasn't always physical asana. It was always more about be very clear about your intention. So that's always resonated with me. And that whole concept of nourishing with intention is not just the body, but that's our relationships, our immediate environment, and of course our global environment, but also nourishing everything, the cells in the body, the mind in particular, and your attitude of gratitude.
That's so beautiful because, yeah, I think like you said, there's only so much we know at the end of the day about food or nutrition, but as long as we're bringing in that intention into everything we're doing, I think that's where the act of nourishing actually makes a difference for your body.
Yeah, absolutely. It really is about that restoration, and sleep, of course, also comes into that nourishment as well.
Yeah. And just to know a little more about your personal journey for our listeners, for people over there, you're a celebrated chef, of course, and your family has been in the restaurant, in the food space since years. So how did you decide to explore food beyond the facet of just taste and go into the healing power of it?
Yeah.
What was that for you?
Well, it's a very personal journey. I had grown up in the restaurant business in Australia, in my hometown of Melbourne in the 1970s and 80s. Melbourne was the restaurant capital of Australia, and these days great food is all over Australia. And my father was a great restaurateur. He was a pioneer in business in Melbourne. He went from different industries and found himself in the restaurant business. And after school and on school holidays, I found myself growing up under the restaurant table, you know, falling asleep at the table. He would, you know, drive us home after work, so to speak. And I absorbed a lot of that. And when I finished my HSC, which is our higher school certificate here, I dabbled with some tertiary education straight out of school. And then I went into the restaurant business, or the hotel business as it was, in the mid-80s. And it was a time where excess was predominant. You know, it was a great economic boom worldwide, but especially in Australia. And to learn the secrets of fine dining, I was an apprentice waiter. So I was front of house for most of my early career, my first 15 years in the trade. And during that time, my father was diagnosed with cancer. And we were best friends. We were very close, my dad and I. And I was, of course, devastated. I was only in my very early 20s. And through his cancer journey, I was shocked, disappointed, discouraged that we knew nothing about nutrition. And he went on to be in remission twice before we actually finally sadly lost him to cancer. And all the oncologists would say to him was the obvious things like reduce your alcohol, stop cigarette smoking, which he had already done, eat more bran, and don't eat so much smoked foods such as smoked salmon. And they were really the guidelines in the mid-80s that he was given. And when I lost him, and after we sold our restaurant during those last few years of being in the restaurant business with my brother, I developed my own self-discovery for health and fitness in my sort of mid-20s by now. Mm. And then I really wanted to understand more about nutrition and how I could have perhaps helped my dad, but also in my naive younger self, how to find a cure for cancer using food as medicine. So that was my impetus. That was my inspiration. And that took me into the beginning of this journey, which really began in 1998.
Wow. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And of course, I think, like you said, it was a personal journey for you and for a lot of people who are moving into or come into the wellness space. I think it does come from their probably seeing someone they love around them or their own journey and, you know, what it is that can be done a bit differently. And it's sad that we move towards how to change our life or how to change our food choices only when, you know, we've already hit something or are diagnosed with something. And earlier, at least no one spoke about it in a way where it was more of a preventive fashion. I think that's the whole concept of how in a preventive fashion can you still make nourishing fun and joyful and playful and, you know, not let it get to, like you said, then they have a list of just do's and don'ts when it becomes restrictive. And it's so great that you, you know, moved into that and you've brought around so much since then in Australia and if, of course, even around. So thank you for sharing that. And I think it's a beautiful inspiration behind, your journey into it.
It's changed so much, and you're so right, because you know, we were looking at daily nutritional maintenance through good food, using the food pyramids and so forth. And really what's happened in the last 10 years, if not more, is that people are now using nutrition as preventative, but as positive preventative. Yeah. And there's still those people who are very invested and realize through the joy of cooking, they can still have great flavor and great flavor profiles and cooking techniques and shared table experiences and fine dining to a certain degree, but there's still a little bit of a one size fits all approach when it comes to food and healing. And unfortunately, that doesn't work, because I know off podcast, off interviews and chats, we've spoken a lot about individuality, and individuality is so important that we just can't assume one person's diet or one particular diet model will work for another person. And, you know, the modern general practitioners and medical practitioners in Australia that aren't so integrated will usually say, you know, diets don't work. So if we start with that, then we're doomed to fail. If they've proven not to work, then that's that's not a great encouragement. So if we can take our health and our nutrition into our own hands and listen to our body and understand that inflammation in the body, you know, causes inflammation in the brain, of the mind, of the emotions, you know, inflammation can create and exacerbate or hyper emotion. And if we can temper ourselves using good food, we'll usually feel better, move better, and hopefully live a bit longer too.
Yeah, I could not agree more, because I think it's you see people getting so lost in all the information that is outside and the nutritional information, like you spoke, that the main concept, the foundation of developing that connection to their body, the body intelligence, is a very abstract concept right now. So usually when you talk about it, people kind of go that, okay, you're talking about it, but what is body intelligence? Or, you know, we're a long way away from cultivating that, and we need to listen to our cravings on a daily basis. So I think for people to connect back to their body, is there anything that you've seen in the food space or in the nutrition space, which, you know, on a holistic level, allows people to start again listening to their body signals and getting more in tune? What would you say is something that people can use as a starting point?
Sure. I think, you know, it really comes back to, you know, the pillars of good health. And for many people, that is hydration. Obviously, it is good food. It is exercise on a regular basis. You know, we're all in agreement that exercise and hydration are fundamental. Nutrition is fundamental. But often the first place I start is sleep. Even though I'm a chef and a nutritionist, I really look at people's sleep or listen to, you know, people's reactions to their sleep. When you talk about sleep, people say, I haven't slept well for a year, or I haven't slept well because of this and that. And if we can tame our sleep patterns, which is a little hard because we're so, a lot of myself included, are dependent on apps to either fall asleep, or I listen to storybooks, audio books, and then they'll be so compelling in the middle of the night. I'm like, what's happened now? So I'll listen to it. I'm interrupting my sleep. And case in point, I was up at 1:30 waiting for the end of my book to see what had happened, you know, which is no good for me. I feel fine, but I know that I'm waking up not as refreshed. And so I think we really need to look at, you know, when, how are we resting? How much light is transmitted from the devices that are helping us fall asleep? Are we reading from the iPad in bed? Are we watching something before bed, and so forth? And how can we boost our sleep, improve our sleep quality, which in turn helps all of those hormonal relationships within the digestion, the serotonin, the mineral deficiencies, and so forth, and helps to amplify the positive impact of neurotransmission. So really, I think sleep, hydration, rest is key, and doing the right kind of exercise that doesn't provoke too much inflammation and a cortisol response in the body. So that's what I look at in the big picture as well.
Yeah.
If people are still eating, you know, still thriving on processed food, particularly drive-through and convenience foods, then of course those red flags need to be addressed immediately because we well know the sugar, the salt, the trans fats, and a lot of those deadly components in there wreak havoc on the cellular body.
Yeah. I think in all these years of practicing this philosophy, have you encountered a specific instance or an experience which has, you know, solidified your belief more on the things we spoke about right now? Because again, it's tough for people to connect the fact that they're eating processed food and that something may be happening in their body 20 years down the line, which is why they're not taking it seriously at this point. So what would you say has strengthened your belief in this?
And I don't know whether it's just about my own aging, but certainly, you know, as we get older, we're more prone to degenerative disease, you know, and things like arthritis, you know, diseases such as arthritis, which is an inflammatory response. And most people think it's from either gardening or doing squats or, you know, or perhaps carrying too much weight. But the gut has a lot to do with it. It really does. And, you know, wheat, particularly in the Western world, is overused. It is exploited. You know, there are so many variations of the humble wheat grain because it so lends itself to occur in so many processed foods. I think wheat is a great place for people to identify what their reactions are. Now, if you're having something like a beautiful sourdough artisan loaf, whether that's a supermarket version, which is still a healthier version than white sliced bread, or you're making it yourself, testing and measuring how you feel the next day. Maybe you have bloating in the face, maybe your lower abdomen is affected, yes. Particularly, you know, for beautiful foods like pasta. A lot of the dehydrated, the dried pasta does cause the lesser quality, can cause a bloating reaction. And usually, particularly for women, it often responds with fatigue, mind fog or brain fog, or just feeling a little bit fuzzy in the brain, not quite clear. And some of those signs, those feelings, not being able to connect or even get the words out, can often be related to some of those ingredients that we're having. So people don't, as you say, they don't often make that connection. They think, oh, maybe yeah. I had too many glasses of wine, maybe I did this, did that, but that's yeah. a combination of it. So I'm not yeah. saying everybody has to eat the most expensive bread and pasta on the market, or that they always have to make their own. But if they take mm-hmm. the time to make pasta or to learn to make pasta, it's actually quite easy, and then have the dried pasta a week later, they'll feel the difference. They'll really notice it. Yeah. And as I say, particularly more so for women, they'll feel that fatigue. Maybe they'll feel a little bit more lymphatic, you know, through the lymph, the lower belly as well. For me, as I've got older, I feel it in my joints, particularly my shoulders and elbows, and definitely my working chef hands. So there's some immediate personal experience, but also that I've been treating clinically for, I guess, more than 25 years, and they're very common occurrences, but they're not just to say that food is the culprit there. It's often a combination of lifestyle as well.
Of course. Yeah. Well, I think that's such a great starting point for people to just kind of see the difference when they're consuming something, because like you said, even I couldn't make that connection for a very long time. I felt a lot of fatigue after waking up. And I think only last year when I started really observing what were the foods and what was different on the days I felt really tired versus not, where I did realize, and for me at that point, gluten was, I was a bit more sensitive to it. So it made me feel a bit more tired the next day. Like you said, the bloating aspect was so big. And I usually have like friends or, you know, people around. If you tell them you're not having gluten or you're intolerant because it's causing fatigue, bloating, again, it's not very relatable. And then sometimes people assume it with you want a diet or it's just another fad, like, you know, I want to go gluten-free. So I think it's so important for people to take that step back and kind of just see how it's working even for them. Because like you said, everyone's different. Bio-individuality comes in. Also, how would you recommend or advise people differentiate from just another fad or a trend or a diet label versus what is actually working for them?
Sure. So, you know, I like to kind of put that under the umbrella of fad, fact, or fashion. And I think if you create three, you know, even a table in your on your computer, you know, if you write down what you think the fads are, what you observe or interpret the fads are, what's the fashion? Because the fashion isn't always a fad. You know, there might be a fashion of a certain food, and then what is the fiction or the fad around that, but also what are the facts? And I think if you correlate a lot of those, you'll see ingredients like wheatgrass were very, very popular back in the 90s, and I was having wheatgrass shots way back then, and I'm a huge believer of wheatgrass. It's just very messy. It's hard to process at home, for example, and juice bars don't sell it anymore. But I wrote a whole nutrition paper around superoxide dismutase, which is the active ingredient for wheatgrass and why it's so good for you and so forth. So I researched that, so there's fact around wheatgrass as an example. However, humble, you know, bunch of parsley will also provide a lot of chlorophyll, a lot of beautiful micronutrients as well. And so that is a proven ingredient. It's very affordable. It's usually available worldwide, whether it's curly continental parsley or flat leaf parsley. And something as simple or as let's say generic as parsley still has super magic powers. So for me, that maybe isn't so fashionable, but still goes into the fact column of our imaginary table. And then we look at the fads. I mean, you just need to scroll through your Instagram. And even in the last few months, it just seems that I'm being bombarded by Instagram advertising now, where I was always happy to see an ad every so often. But it's just the more I want to know somewhere else, the more it turns up by someone by an influencer. And I'm like, actually not quite right. You know, that's not the science. That's just your interpretation or your opinion. And therefore that becomes fashion and or fad as well. So I think we have to be really clear about our intention. We have to do the work. And unfortunately, when it comes to diets and food and healing, a lot of people, they don't want to do the work. They want the work done for them.
Yeah.
But if you're doing, you know, some really intentional weight loss or weight gain for a lot of people as well, you know, you're really wanting to make some serious changes, you can still do that with an integrated approach with your doctor, but also by researching what is good for you. For example, alcohol is a very powerful inflammator, and I know in your culture there are components, I'm sure, of cultures in India that celebrate alcohol, and there are certainly some components and some cultures, subcultures, that don't celebrate alcohol. And alcohol is a very festive, joyful drink in moderation, but it's also a great inflamer. And as you get older, I've noticed, and certainly for younger people as well these days, I think through COVID, where alcohol was probably more consumed, alcohol and anxiety, that relationship or that interconnection really is a very powerful weapon and not really used to anyone's benefit. And I think that's something that, you know, if we're looking at food trends, lifestyle trends, then the whole hashtag, which is very, very valid, about sober curious, is also really interesting. I know for me, I've really cut back on alcohol consumption from last year, and I just feel so much better. I feel up here, I feel so much better, which is not why I was doing it at all. But I feel much, much more at peace, and not that I'm telling anyone else to do it by any means. It's just an example that there seems to be a lot more of that sobriety happening around, which is a great thing as well.
Recently, I was on vacation last week, and my alcohol consumption was higher than it usually is. And I could feel myself run a bit more anxious the next day, and a little more edgy. And it's not about a hangover, but the next day and maybe even, you know, 2 days later, I found a difference in my in how I felt. So I think it's really interesting that you made that connection and that you brought it up, because we don't very obviously relate alcohol to maybe how we're feeling mentally a day or 2 days later, but it's also beautifully interconnected, and that's where the whole nourish with intention comes in.
Absolutely. And you know, I'm all for celebration and parties and cocktails and so forth. I'm, you know, for those people that really continue to want to do that, you know, it's fantastic. I usually say, you know, choose your alcohol wisely. Having been in the restaurant industry, and certainly when I was much younger in the wine industry, I was much more involved and curious about New World wine and, of course, traditional French winemaking and the wines of Italy and throughout Europe. But I'm not as invested, so it's a little easier for me to let go of that those experiences that I kind of used to have as well.
What influences the ingredients you pick, the dishes you choose to create as a spa cuisine guru?
So it usually starts with the client. So if the spa, the health retreat, the hotel, you know, has certain guidelines, which of course they do, then those menus will be designed around their guidelines. For example, one spa may be dairy-free, gluten-free, alcohol-free, sugar-free. And so that can usually be quite overwhelming for a conventional executive chef, but it's really not that overwhelming. It's just a matter of knowing flavor combination. So we would then introduce a lot of plant-based ingredients, of course, and we look at flavor profiling. And a lot of people think that healthy food is brown and boring, but it's about understanding how to develop umami, particularly looking at developing flavors that your customers want more of. So we all have a favorite food, you know, we all have a favorite flavor. We're disappointed if we go to a restaurant and have our favorite spaghetti bolognese as a classic Australian restaurant family dish, and it's not the same as our grandmother would make, as an example, because she would have made it very differently to somebody else, or your grandfather, or even your parents. So looking at all the traditional curries, you know, looking at all of those spices that are used in curries, the dry spices, the fresh aromatics, they're all there for a reason. All those flavors are there to create layers, to build flavor. And you know more than I do that, you know, when you dry fry spices, you bring out the best qualities, don't you? You, instead of adding a little bit of paprika at the end or ground cumin, for example, before you serve the dish, that doesn't do anything except get caught in your teeth or your mouthfeel. So it's really about those ancient understandings, those ancient traditions of culinary wisdom and how our ancestors used to develop flavors. So I think about the cultural dish that I'm making and where those flavors, what goes with those ingredients, and where those flavors have come from. And then that always gives me an indication. If someone wants a Japanese-y kind of flavor, then I look at seaweed. I look at certain fish that they would like to have that. I bring in miso and ginger and all of those gorgeous flavors that I know really, really well from my experience of working in Japanese restaurants and teaching Japanese cooking. Yesterday I flew back from Sydney, for example. There's nothing in our fridge. My husband's been away on the road working for more than a week. And there was a packet of halloumi and a bag of baby carrots and some lemons. And usually that wouldn't give you very much. But by the time I, you know, pan-fried that, roasted some honey carrots, pulled some parsley out of the garden and some fried oregano, it was gorgeous, you know. And it was just a very simple meal, the tiniest, you know, ingredients, but it saved me from certainly buying takeout, not that I would do that very often, but defrosting something from our freezer, you know what I mean? So I just had to make the most of it. So flavor combination is learned, but it also comes back to years of me reading and writing recipes, but also understanding what those, where those flavors come from. Now, a lot of those kind of flavors, I haven't been to a lot of Middle Eastern countries, but I was trying to mimic some of those dishes, certainly Italian style, style flavors as well. So a lot of that is a practice, you know, it's like learning an instrument. The more you understand.
I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised that you could take any ingredient, no matter how lonely it was, just like one ingredient or whatever, and make it an exciting dish. So of course you did that. But you know, that's
Sometimes I'm not in the mood to do that, and I'll just, I couldn't even be bothered to do that, you know, particularly if I've been traveling, you know, and like, I'm too tired, you know. So I totally understand when people say I'm too tired to cook. It's not the physical act of cooking. They're too tired to think about what's for dinner. Understand, you know.
Yeah, and I think what you mentioned about healthy food not having to be brown and boring, that ties back, because one of the biggest challenges people face is the perception of it not tasting as good and the time and the effort that would go into it. So for people to witness how easy it is, or the fact that convenience and taste can go hand in hand, is there something you recommend they can include, they can do in their daily practice?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in our restaurant journey, in commercial cookery, we always have mise en place. We always have that preparation done, and that's often done in a large kitchen. There's a large brigade, and there's usually a larder chef who will, or a larder cook sometimes, or the line cook maybe also will do that cold preparation, the cold larder chef. And that is their job, to upkeep all the lettuce, to make sure that all the ingredients are prepped, that all those organic ingredients have been washed and thoroughly dried. The carrots are topped and tailed, and perhaps, you know, all of those other ingredients have been paired and so forth. So preparation is key, but these days you can buy really good quality frozen ingredients, like frozen peas we have a lot of in this country, but frozen spinach, where you think that you are too tired or you don't have enough healthy food, you can make a great meal out of toasted nuts and seeds from your pantry, some steamed brown rice, and some frozen green vegetables, you know, preferably best quality that you can find. Although there might not be pure protein in there, you'll still get really beautiful benefits of eating whole grains and the alkalization from, let's say, some frozen spinach, as long as you cook it properly and don't, you know, microwave it so there's nothing left. So you can still make, you know, good wholesome food, and then you can build those flavor profiles with different seasonings. We use a lot of seaweed salts here as well, so we get those flavors. And then the sprinkling of toasted nuts and seeds will give you the essential fatty acids as well. So sometimes when I'm tired, that's a real go-to, and it's actually more delicious than I give it credit for when I'm making it. But it maybe takes 20 minutes of brown rice to cook, or white rice, basmati, whatever you want to use. Then I think you can do beautiful things with that.
What does nourishing mean for you? What are the food practices or the choices that you would usually adopt in the day? Is there something specific you stick to? Would love to know a little about that.
Well, at the moment, you know, it's very seasonal. My philosophy is always seasonal. At the moment in our country or my region, it's been very, very humid, but now the thunderstorms are coming. We've actually had almost like Asian monsoon weather here. It's been quite intense. And so you don't feel like having, you know, really heavy food. It's, you need something light and food that's very easily digested. And I think that also happens, particularly for a lot of Australians who travel to Bali a lot, and that might be their first introduction to Southeast Asian cuisine. And for a lot of Australian people, it's their only introduction to spicy food, and whether they like it or not. And even though they're having more spicy food, as Bali as an example, they do understand that they're feeling all of those beautiful spices. You know, they can feel the benefit of those spices, the way it causes you to heat up and then cool down. They can have a really first-hand interpretation of that. And that's the way I encourage people to eat here in the late summer. We actually call this time of year in Australia the Indian summer, because it does continue, or late summer, or long summer. Sometimes it's very dry, but because of El Nino, I think, and La Nina, you know, we have those crossover seasons. So having said that, our crops are very different, and what's available, such as tomatoes, simply aren't available from our farmers' markets. You know, they stopped producing about 2 or 3 weeks ago, whereas you'll always find them in a supermarket, but as we know, they don't taste that great. So even my small patch of tomatoes I grow here at home, they haven't produced any tomatoes since the rain has come. But the other ingredients flourish. So, you know, we need to understand, you know, what is the garden doing? And perhaps I just have a small garden at home. I've got a huge garden, but a small vegetable garden. You know, what's actually growing? And the eggplants and the chilies have stopped growing. So even though I like those foods, it's time to dry out those chilies and use them to heat up the food as well. So eating with the seasons and eating in tune with the changing weather is really, really important, because then all of the systems in the body will respond to that as well.
Yeah, that brings me to something I wanted to ask about. How does eating local or eating seasonal produce, according to you, benefit our health and also in terms of sustainability?
I think it's really important for everyone to understand that when you eat locally, the ingredients that you are purchasing or harvesting are coming from the soil that is very similar or synergistic to the soil that you're living on. So your physical environment, your actual, you know, agricultural environment, if you eat locally, then those carrots, for example, have grown in soil full of minerals, minerally rich, that supports also the minerals that are in your natural environment in your nearby town. That is so important, you know, particularly when we look at salt in Australia. A lot of our salt, we have beautiful salt that comes from Australia, yet we're still importing organic salts, which is terrific, mineral salts such as Himalayan salt and Celtic sea salt from very far away places. And yes, they may be, some of them may be certified organic, but I always question, aren't our local salts, because it's salt of the earth, don't they have such a full-bodied mineral dance, a whole component of the minerals that service the minerals that we are? Because at the end of the day, we break down into minerals, and we know that because we know that we break down in, you know, we lose our skin and we come down to bone, which of course is made up of essentially calcium deposits and so many other minerals. So looking at the minerals that your food is grown in, I always believe should reflect the minerals that you spend most of that environmental time in, you know, the minerals that are in the environment that you spend time in. It's really important. It doesn't mean you don't have to do that all the time, but when you come back to shopping at your local market, you'll usually taste the food and the food will resonate with you more so than when you've put it in a plastic bag from the supermarket.
So what makes you feel inspired or creative in the kitchen? Because I feel so often I get into a rut where I'm using the same ingredients or cooking up the same things. And, you know, like you said, for a lot of people, it's about what they should cook. And that's where the barrier comes in. So how do you stay creative? How do you stay inspired?
I think it's really important to sit back and just or step back. I think it's really important when you've been in a really intense creative space. Sometimes when I've been doing different projects back to back, then I love it because it's often working with other people's ideas and other people's concepts, I should say, and then they might want a recipe around their particular product, but they've already got the product, which is the star of the show. So it makes my work rather easy because we're highlighting their macadamia nuts, for example, or their particular fish component or whatever protein they're creating. So it's about developing those flavors. But then there are times where if I can become quite stuck, it's like, oh, and it's usually because I'm overwhelmed and I usually need to go out and eat some other people's food, see what other restaurants are doing and see what flavors are working really well, because I have my default cuisines that I always come back to, but sometimes some recipe or some client will ask me to create more European style food or more French food. So I'll have to practice some of those classic French five sauces that make up the foundations of French cuisine and make a lot more stocks from scratch and so forth. So usually by doing that, then I get inspired. I've been cooking since I was about 5 or 6 years old. So it's an innate love or an inherent component for me. So I think, you know, sometimes I'm the wrong person to ask because it's so ingrained in myself to work with food. Just as I suspect paint is for a painter, I also am a ceramicist when I have time and I can find the studios to work with. So to work with clay is an extension of working with food for me, because clay takes on so many different forms. And at the end of the day, clay is usually baked in an oven or a kiln. So there's a lovely end process that goes after decorating, you know. So I find there's a glorious synergy between ceramics, as an example, and food, and working with food on a regular basis. I find when I do get disconnected, I've either done too much work or I'm not doing enough work, the work I'm meant to be doing, and then I'll start looking, going a little bit left of centre to look for other work around, and it's not actually, it doesn't come back to my core business and what I truly love to do, which is to create recipes, write cookbooks, mentor people such as yourself, and help people become better wellness business entrepreneurs.
That's such a simple yet profound step of how we can all, you know, take a step back and create more space in our life, in our mind, when we are feeling overwhelmed or blocked. And of course, not only related to food, but for anyone, for anything. Sam, I could actually talk to you for hours. You carry so much wisdom, and I have so many questions. There's so much more I would love to know, and would love to have you back for another episode. But in the interest of time, I will end with one last question. So what, according to you, is the one step that someone who's looking at, you know, starting on their health and wellness journey, or just making better choices in general, what is that one step they can take or they can start with so as to feel less overwhelmed and less confused about everything out there?
Absolutely. That's a fantastic place to end this first conversation with you. And that's really start with the end in mind and remember that health and optimal wellness is just that. It is a journey. It really is. And so the small incremental changes you make within the next week or the next month is so much a step in the right direction than if you don't do anything at all. So do things slowly. Try not to completely overhaul your pantry. It's really expensive. It's not very sustainable to do that. But start to investigate some different, maybe some herbs, maybe some spices, maybe some pre-prepared spice mixes, for example, that you can introduce to make the flavors in your food taste great and to take the pressure off yourself.
That's beautiful. It's so refreshing talking to you. And like I said, I could go on for hours still. And thank you so much for being there. Thank you so much for talking with me. And would love to see you back again soon.
Thank you for having me. It's been lovely to see you. Stay well, everyone.
Thank you for listening. Be sure to rate, review, and share with anyone you think might enjoy these conversations. Stay tuned for more.